Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The Security Council mandated two guests today. The historian Rashid Khalidi will review the long war in the Palestinian people, and the political scientist Aurélie Dyer will talk about Hezbollah in the wake of Israel's assassination of its leader, Hassan Nasrallah. My first guest is the distinguished historian Rashid Khalidi. Khalidi's family was a member of the old Palestinian elite that was destroyed in 1948 when Israel, freshly born as a state, expelled 750,000 Palestinians from their homes to make way for the settlers. Along with the larger history, he writes extensively about that family in his book, The 100 Years' War in Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017, which is published by Metropolitan Books in 2020. It's not a new book, though Behind the News has never been impressed with novelty for novelty's sake, but it has acquired a new relevance given the latest phase of that century-long war. Khalidi has been an academic for much of his life, but he's also been deeply involved in Palestinian politics over the years. He's just retired from teaching at Columbia, where he now has emeritus status. We talk about the Balfour Declaration. That document, issued by the British government in 1917 by the Foreign Secretary Alfred Balfour, announced its commitment to the establishment of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. While there were some Jews living there, they only accounted for about 6% of the total population. The declaration made no mention of the Palestinians, who were the majority of the locals at that time. The declaration was a crucial stepping-off point to the creation of the State of Israel. Rashid Khalidi. So applying the term settler colonial to Israel really annoys its supporters, but not only is it accurate, it's pretty much the language the early Zionists used. Could you review the history of that discourse?
The early Zionist leadership, people like Theodor Herzl, Chaim Weizmann, Zev Jabotinsky, Ben-Gurion himself, all believed they had a right to take over Palestine. They believed they had a biblical right. They believed they had a right as people persecuted in Europe and in need of a refuge. They represented a national movement or an attempt to develop a national movement out of Judaism and the Jewish people, a modern national movement. At the same time, none of them made any bones about the fact that they were doing this as part of a settler colonial process. The names of the institutions, like the Jewish Colonization Agency, one of the major institutions that was involved in taking over land from Palestinians, indicates that they understood that this was a process of colonization. The one who was the most open about it was Jabotinsky, who said that, you know, this is a colonial process. We have a right here, but we understand that this is like any other colonial process, and colonized peoples always will resist. Others were less forthright about it, but they all understood the same thing, that whatever their rights were, whatever the justice of their cause in their eyes was, they were doing something that involved displacing an entire people in a colonial process. Nobody ever contested that, really, before World War II. When suddenly decolonization began and colonialism had a bad odor globally. And so Israel, the Zionist movement, and then later Israel, began to describe itself as an anti-colonial actor because they had come into conflict with the British for a number of years during and immediately after World War II. But the colonial settler nature of this was confirmed after Israel's victory in 1947-48, 1949, when they expelled 750,000 Palestinians, stole their land, refused to allow them to return, took over all of their property. This is settler colonialism. There's no other description for it, really. And anybody with eyes to see who has watched the process of the colonization of the West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem and the occupied Golan Heights since 1967 cannot see anything but settler colonialism. I mean, I cannot imagine how you would describe it unless you're a biblical fanatic and say this is the return of the Jewish people to a land to which only they have rights. Well, if you believe that, we are not involved in the same discourse.
A striking thing reading the history is how the Zionist project has relied on imperial patrons, which counters all the David and Goliath metaphors the settlers
right.
used to sell their project. First was Britain, now the U.S. Sometimes one wonders what was in it for the patrons. So let's talk a bit about the British. Why their fervor from Balfour onwards? The British ruling class has a long history of anti-Semitism. Did it just want to get the Jews out of Europe? What explains their fervor for the project?
Two things explain the fervor for the project. The first is ideological. It goes back to the early 19th century, before modern political Zionism had ever developed, before even the first modern political Zionist writings were committed to paper. And this has to do with a movement in the Anglican Church in England and among Protestants generally, a great renewal of faith and a rereading of the Bible such that the return of the Jews to the Holy Land was seen as a bounden Christian duty in order to hasten the second coming of Christ and so forth. We get this same view among many evangelicals in the United States today. This starts in the early 19th century, both in the United States and in Britain. The figure most closely associated with it is a very influential British aristocrat by the name of Lord Shaftesbury. He was the father-in-law of the British Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston. He and many others pushed this, and this became ingrained in the British Protestantism, this understanding that it was a bounden duty to return the Jews to the Holy Land. Now, it just happens that at the same time, you have, as you pointed out, a deep strain of anti-Semitism in England, which goes back to the 12th century when King Edward kicked all the Jews out of England. It was one of many cases where European rulers expelled the entire Jewish population. The King of France did it in the 13th century. The kings of Spain and Portugal did it in the end of the 15th century. And that virulent, theologically based anti-Semitism was there at the same time as you had this, I guess you'd call it philo-Semitism or Christian Zionism, among members of the British ruling class. The great irony is that Lord Balfour, who obviously is the person who pens the Balfour Declaration on behalf of the British cabinet in November 1917, in a previous incarnation as Conservative Prime Minister, was responsible for one of the most anti-Semitic acts since King Edward, which was the Alien Exclusion Act, to prevent Jewish refugees from the pogroms, the deadly pogroms that were going on in the Russian Empire at the turn of the 20th century, from coming to Britain. So you have both of those elements, which have to do with both philo-Semitism and Christian Zionism and anti-Semitism. And secondly, and I think much more important, you have a strategic element. Britain realized early on in the 20th century that it was absolutely vital to its strategic interests, control of the shortest route to India, which meant control of the Suez Canal in Egypt, which meant protecting the eastern frontier of Egypt, which they saw as vulnerable, and which in fact turned out during World War I to be vulnerable, by controlling Palestine. And the related realization that there was a possibility of the building of a railway between the Mediterranean and the Gulf, which would become the shortest land route through the Mediterranean and via railway to the Gulf. And the British decided they had to control that as well. That's why you have some very peculiar shapes on the map today. That eastern arm of Jordan, which connects with the western edge of Iraq, is a British concoction to ensure British control of that shortest land route between the Gulf and the Mediterranean. And Palestine is the Mediterranean terminus of that. So for multiple strategic reasons, the British had decided long before Chaim Weizmann came along, long before Balfour was foreign secretary, that they needed to control Palestine. This was a decision of the Committee of Imperial Defense, of the British General Staff, of British ministers in 1906, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, long before the Balfour Declaration. So strategic reasons, and the idea that the Zionist movement would be a useful pawn in this. It enabled Britain, after World War I, to welch on their promises to other countries to have an international regime in Palestine and to take Palestine for themselves. So there are strategic reasons and the ideological reasons that I mentioned.
Over time, the Zionists have proved very skilled at playing their imperial masters to their advantage.
One of the things you have to understand, if you accept that this is a settler colonial project, is that it's unique. It's different than any other. Most of the others are extension of the sovereignty and the population of the mother country. Zionism didn't have a mother country, but it needed an external metropole. And so Herzl ran around Europe to the Kaiser, to the French, to the Ottoman Sultan to try and find that external patron. Weizmann hit pay dirt in London with the British government. That was something they always understood, that it's absolutely vital to keep these external patron or patrons, because the project necessitates that anchor in Europe and later on in the United States. That's something that they used to their advantage when the British decided to limit their promises to the Zionists in 1939, and they pivoted very quickly to the United States and the Soviet Union, who became their patrons in the immediate post-war period, pushing through the partition resolution, which is the birth certificate of the State of Israel, the 1947 General Assembly resolution partitioning Palestine. They're both recognizing the State of Israel immediately. It's established in May 1948, and providing Israel with the arms, which enable it to defeat the four Arab armies that it fought against in the 1948 war. This attentiveness to external patrons. They later on shift to Britain and France, who supply most of their weapons in the 50s and 60s. The weapons that they win the 1956 war and the 1967 war are mainly French and British weapons, and it's the French who gave them the wherewithal to develop their nuclear weapons. Later on, they pivot to the Americans. So there's always been a concern to maintain an anchor in a Western European / American metropole for this project, even as it became, you know, based in Israel after the establishment of the state.
I don't want to emphasize the flaws and weaknesses of the Palestinian side too much, given the overwhelming power and brutality of Israel and its patrons, but there are some issues to talk about here. One, you write a lot about your family, which was part of a Palestinian elite. You're critical of that elite. It didn't seem up to the task, to use the Marxist language, of forming a national bourgeoisie. What were its limitations?
Well, the first thing is that it was largely not a bourgeois leadership. The first thing is that it was largely a leadership rooted in the traditional notable class, which were people who were landowners, which were people who were part of the bureaucratic elite of the Ottoman Empire and who hoped to continue that role under the British and their brethren and sistern, or mainly brethren, in other Arab countries did that. They were not a bourgeoisie. The bourgeoisie was a junior partner in that leadership of the 1920s and 1930s. They were not particularly democratic. They were not engaged in mass politics for the most part. They were traditional leadership of what Albert Hanani called notables, the kind of people who had been part of Ottoman governance for generations and generations, centuries actually. And they hoped and assumed that they could continue to play that role under the British. They were sorely mistaken because they fundamentally misunderstood what the British were doing. The British intended to replace them and their people with an entirely different leadership and an entirely different people. That's what the Balfour Declaration said. That's what the Mandate for Palestine said. And one of the great failures of this leadership was to realize this early enough. I mean, eventually, Palestinians realized this and rose up in revolt, but it wasn't a revolt that was organized by or led by this traditional leadership. It was a grassroots, popular uprising that led to a 3-year rebellion that the British only put down with great difficulty. And the leadership doesn't come off well in my reading and in the reading of, I think, most historians during this period from World War I to 1948.
And you also write about how over the decades the leadership of the PLO has been ill-prepared, no match for their Israeli counterparts, no political strategy to influence outside opinion. The leadership enjoyed its perks and forgot their constituents. Now, we shouldn't overlook how many of the most dynamic leaders Israel assassinated, even in the cultural sphere, but the leadership has been fairly unimpressive. Why?
Well, I think a couple of things. They achieved certain things. I mean, I'm very critical of them, but you have to give them credit for resuscitating the Palestinian national movement in the 50s and 60s at a time when everybody thought that Palestine had disappeared from the map. The Israelis were gloating. I believe it was Golda Meir who said, the old will die and the young will forget. Well, the old died, but the young did not forget. And it was this leadership that revived the Palestinian national movement, to their credit. It had been completely destroyed, shattered. The previous leadership was discredited. They were all scattered to the winds. That class and those individuals and those families that had dominated Palestinian politics up to 1948 disappear from the political map. You see nothing. They disappear. There's nobody from any of that old elite. And the new ones, to their credit, resuscitate the Palestinian national movement and get the Palestinians a seat at the table. Now, what they did with that seat is where the burden of my criticism comes in, which is that they utterly failed, I think, to understand the global balance of power, to understand the United States and Western Europe, to understand how those places functioned and how hard it would be to overcome the visceral nature of Western support for the Zionist project and for Israel. I think a comparison with the Zionist movement and Israeli leaders is quite useful here. You're talking, in the case of people like Herzl, Ben-Gurion, Chaim Weizmann, people like later on Abba Iban, Golda Meir, Benjamin Netanyahu, of people who are Americans, Europeans, in their origins, in their education, in their outlook, in their training, in their language, in their culture, and are also Israelis or Zionists, for the ones who like Herzl, who die long before the state is created. Jabotinsky, all of these are people who are at home in the European milieu. They understand Europe and the United States. Golda Meir lived in Milwaukee for years. Netanyahu lived in Philadelphia and at Cornell, where his dad was teaching, for years. You listen to them. You listen to Abba Iban, you listen to Golda Meir, you listen to Benjamin Netanyahu, and you're hearing the accents of natives from this country. And that's true of Abba Iban speaking perfect Oxford English. He was South African by origin. So you're talking about an elite in the Zionist movement and later in Israel, a large proportion of whom profoundly understand Western culture and politics because they were part of it. That's not the case for the Palestinians. Until the present generation, you do not have people who've grown up and have been steeped in Western politics, Western culture, Western languages, Western law. And they therefore were at an enormous disadvantage by comparison with Zionist and later Israeli leaders in dealing with the West, whether strategically or in terms of public relations or diplomatically or in any other way. And that has shown, unfortunately, in the performance of the PLO, well, the Palestinian leadership of the 20s and the 30s, but the performance of the PLO and more recently of the Palestinian Authority. They're pathetically out of their depth in dealing with the United States and Western countries. The PLO did a pretty good job dealing with the Third World. They were relatively successful. They could understand that global South because they were part of it. They could relate to it. They could speak to it. They did not have the same facility with the United States and Western Europe.
I'm speaking with the historian Rashid Khalidi, author of The 100 Years War in Palestine, published by Metropolitan Books. I can understand the Cold War logic of an alliance with Israel as a bulwark against communism. The USSR has been dead for over 30 years. Most Arab regimes are now very reliable U.S. allies. So how do you explain the lingering support for Israel and its absolutely manic intensity?
Well, there's multiple elements. I mean, you have the evangelical element, which, you know, is a through line from Britain in the 1930s and 1830s and 40s through the United States in the 2020s. That is a base of support that is solid in every era, given that it's theologically grounded. Second thing that you have that's important is that all of the leading institutions of the Jewish community have been won over to Zionism between the 1940s and the 1960s. Most Jewish communities in most parts of the world were not particularly favorable to Zionism until Hitler comes to power in the 30s and until the Holocaust. That's true in the United States. It's true in Europe. People voted with their feet. Thousands went to Palestine. Millions went to the United States and Canada and Australia. Or they stayed and tried to change their societies or keep their heads down. They were not convinced of the tenets of Zionism until European anti-Semitism reached this mad paroxysm of the Holocaust. And that, understandably, changed a lot of people's minds. And by the 1960s, the American Jewish establishment, if you can call it that, the leading institutions of the American Jewish community, had come to treat Israel as a central element in Jewish identity, as they came to treat the Holocaust as a central element of self-understanding. And the two were seen as linked, of course. So that's another element. It's increasingly, I think, unrepresentative of younger generations of people in the Jewish community. But it's certainly true of the people in the 60s and 70s who own most of the money and control most of the institutions, you know, the Conference of Presidents and the ADL and the American Jewish Committee and so forth, are run by people whose political consciousness was formed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And that was an era in which an Israeli narrative took root in that community. And then finally, you have strategic elements. I mean, you're absolutely right that Israel was a particularly valuable ally during the Cold War. It was seen as the Trump proxy against Soviet proxies. But you're also right that the Cold War ended in 1991 with the demise of the Soviet Union, and that the United States has continued to see Israel as a valuable ally because the United States has found other bogeymen to justify its strategic stranglehold over the Middle East, the Islamic Revolution in Iran and the regime that grew out of that. And then later on, various terrorist outfits like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And Israel successfully sold itself at the turn of the 21st century to the United States as an indispensable ally in the global war on terror. And we see this today in the seamless cooperation between the American intelligence services and the American military with Israel in hunting down Hamas leaders in Gaza and in hunting down Hezbollah leaders in Lebanon. There's a reportage in the New York Times, which is the propaganda outlet for Israel in the United States, the main propaganda outlet for Israel in the United States. This is taking place. And this goes back to this idea that Israel, that these things are joined at the hip. Everything that the United States finds objectionable in the Middle East, including global terrorist outfits like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, are no different than Hamas and Hezbollah, which of course have national roots and national causes and are rooted in the Palestine issue and in Israel's occupation of Lebanon, and not in some global Islamic. But there's a narrative that Israel succeeded in selling in this country. Netanyahu played a crucial role in this, but it was Ariel Sharon who was really the most successful salesman at the outset, such that the United States has hitched itself essentially to Israel's war on a variety of actors in the Middle East, with the complete illusion that these are America's enemies, just as they're Israel's enemies. It's hard to see exactly how Hamas is the United States' enemy, except that it's linked to Iran, and this hostility between the United States and Iran, this enmity, goes back to the Iranian Revolution.
You wrote in the book, The 100 Years War, which was published in 2020, so I guess you wrote these words maybe 2018 or 19. You wrote about how American public opinion was changing, and we've certainly seen that accelerate over the last year. How wobbly is a Zionist discursive hegemony these days in the U.S.?
Well, it depends on who you talk about. If you talk about public opinion in general, I think that hegemony has disappeared. It's fighting a rearguard action. And because its narrative is so threadbare, it's obliged to resort to completely spurious allegations of anti-Semitism to smear people who are calling for Palestinian freedom or people who are decrying the slaughter of civilians in Gaza and now in Lebanon. On that level, it's fighting a rearguard action. On the elite level, however, on the level of the mainstream corporate media, on the level of the great institutions of our society, the universities, the museums, the foundations, on the level of our politics, it's still hegemonic. There's not a politician who doesn't repeat some drivel that's drawn from this Israeli playbook every time they open their mouth. The only democracy in the Middle East, a country that's kept a population almost as large as the Jewish population of Israel under prison camp conditions and military occupation since 1957, is the only democracy in the Middle East. Millions of Palestinians have lived under the jackboot of a military government, locked up in Gaza or held in cantonments all over the West Bank by Israeli walls and Israeli checkpoints without any right to determine anything about their lives, whether they can go, they can come, they can import, they can export, they can register their children in the without Israeli permission. That's a democracy. There isn't a politician who doesn't repeat that nauseating lie. Roger Cohen, today's New York Times, shared democratic values. So let me see, torture in prison camps is a democratic value. Slaughtering civilians at a ratio of 3-1 or 4-1 as against your nominal enemies is a democratic value. That bilge is repeated ad nauseum by all of the elites, whether the political or the media or the corporate or the other elites. So on one level, that narrative is still hegemonic. And that's unfortunately the level of the people who own and control our politics and our economy and our much of our cultural production. At a grassroots level, among artists, among students, among unions, among churches, and among minorities, that narrative is in deep, deep trouble.
Is there a way out of where we are? One secular democratic state sounds appealing, but impossible to imagine. The old two-state solution, with the Palestinian one fully sovereign and not an apartheid-style bantustan. That seems almost as dreamy, more than ever after this latest round of bloodletting, and given the destruction of the civilizational infrastructure of the Palestinians and the hardening of Israeli attitudes. Can you imagine any kind of plausible solution at this point?
Well, I don't think anything is possible in the immediate future, given what you just said. I mean, Israel suffered a series of traumatic shocks on October 7th. It was the first invasion of Israeli territory since 1948. It was the largest civilian death toll in Israel since 1948. It was the first, I would argue, the most severe defeat of Israel's military, certainly since 1973. And 800 civilians were slaughtered, were killed. It was a massive intelligence failure. The traumatic shock of all of that is still reverberating in Israel and has very much hardened Israeli attitudes. The slaughter of 42,000 people in Gaza, as you can imagine, has hardened Palestinian attitudes. And the ongoing slaughter of whatever it is, whatever the toll is, 1,200 people, most of whom, as always with the Israelis, are civilians, is going to harden attitudes in Lebanon and other parts of the Middle East. So nothing can be envisaged in the short term. In the medium and long term, you're going to see decreasing support for Israel in the West. This ludicrous idea of shared values is going to be tattered. Now, Western values may change. The West may become more autocratic, more undemocratic, more hostile to the rest of the world. That's certainly possible. The rhetoric of a Trump or the rhetoric of an Orban or the rhetoric of the Austrian party that just won the elections indicates that that's a possibility, in which case Israel is a perfect ally, tramples all over international humanitarian law, spits at the United Nations, is hostile and racist towards non-Jews. That's an attitude that I think a lot of major political parties, including the Republican Party, would find perfectly congenial. But unless that is the future of Western European countries and the United States, there's going to be a separation of ways between this absolutely essential metropole and this project in Israel. And there's going to be a problem within Israel, because a lot of people are going to say, is this the country I want to bring my children up to live in? There's a flight of people from the Middle East. There's a flight of Israelis from Israel. There's a flight of Palestinians and Lebanese as well. 100,000 people, Lebanese, left for Syria in the last 24, 48 hours. Imagine going to Syria, a war-torn country, because you're in such danger in Lebanon. But, you know, Lebanon, Palestine, Jordan, Egypt, Syria, those countries are going to endure. Israel is going to have a problem, because the kind of people who are leaving are the doctors from the hospitals, the high-tech folks, the investors, the professors, the more liberal element of Israeli society, and also the more educated and more productive members of Israeli society. And this is going to be a problem going forward. Do you really want your children to be occupying South Lebanon in 2030? Do you really want your children to be occupying Gaza in 2028? Well, that's the future that this regime, this government in Israel, is plotting for that country. I don't think that that's a very, that's a future that a number of Israelis, at least, are going to enjoy living with.
That was Rashid Khalidi, a professor emeritus of Arab Studies at Columbia and author of The 100 Years' War in Palestine, published by Metropolitan. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after musical break. Some of the first movement in Dmitri Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 8, performed by the Sorel Quartet. Next, a look at Hezbollah, in the wake of Israel's pager attack and the assassination of its longtime leader, Hassan Nasrallah. For that, we're joined by Aurélie Daher. She is a professor of political science at University of Paris Dauphine and Sciences Po Paris, or I guess Sciences Po if you say Paris. Her book, Hezbollah, Mobilization and Power, originally published in French in 2014, was published in English in 2019 by Oxford University Press. Something to keep in mind as we listen. When Aurélie Daher was on this show in January, she emphasized the scope and complexity of Hezbollah. Not only is it highly disciplined, it has a civilian side that is deeply embedded in Lebanese society through a network of civilian social welfare organizations and through political activity. Aurélie Daher. How dependent was Hezbollah on Nasrallah's leadership? If you read the American papers, for example, it's like cutting the head off of the organization, and it has inspired this real triumphalist spirit, both in Israel and in its supporters in the U.S. Now, they've assassinated top leaders before to little long-term effect. Is this different? What the effects going to be as far as you can estimate?
First thing we need to understand that Hezbollah is a big organization, big machine, lots of departments, etc. And Nasrallah didn't run it alone. Okay, it's a teamwork. The leadership is collegial. Nasrallah is like the face of the organization. He's the guy who gives the most important discourses, etc. But the decisions are made in a collegial way, and running the house is also collegial. So the disappearance of Nasrallah does have an impact on the organization because, well, first of all, he was, I mean, whether we like what he was or not, whether we agree or not with his ideas, everybody agrees on the fact that he was a very clever man. He ran the Hezbollah organization brilliantly. I mean, he is the one that really made Hezbollah what it is today. The problem is for those who are now celebrating with a lot of champagne the fact that he was assassinated by the Israeli army. The problem is that, again, he's not alone. The replacement is already there. there. The leadership is learning their lesson in terms of obviously how they're going to rework on their communication system, on protecting maybe better the next secretary general, etc., the new strategy, or at least at short term, middle term. They are looking into all of that. But that definitely does not mean that Hezbollah is over. I was listening to the Israeli ambassador in Paris this morning, and he was obviously bragging about the fact that Hezbollah is gone, Hezbollah is over. That's absolutely not the case. Most of the organization, whether the civil part of it or the military, they're still there. They did lose a few military commanders, but guess what? I mean, Hezbollah works like an army. So in any army, when you lose officers, then you have other officers to replace them. So that's going to be that's something that is already under process. And another thing that I think maybe the Israeli didn't foresee is that the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, who was not just a brilliant leader, but he was also seen by a large part of the Lebanese population as also a father, a protector, somebody very charismatic, a living legend for Shia religious people. He was even the person annunciating the return of the Mahdi. It's a millennialist thing in Shiaism. You know, supposedly we're going to have that imam, that kind of saint who's going to come back at the end of times to resuscitate the dead, establish a reign of justice, a little bit like in Christianity, you know, with Jesus, etc. But before that, we're going to have also an Antichrist. And obviously, from a Shia point of view, the Antichrist is in Tel Aviv. Hassan Nasrallah had a kind of almost a divine dimension in this. Yes, he was different from other leaders, but that didn't change anything to the resolve of the organization. Quite the opposite. I think the Israelis, what they don't see is that right now we have like a new generation of young men who are extremely enthusiastic at the idea of joining Hezbollah, of avenging the death of Hassan Nasrallah. Then we also have to keep in mind that just like in every army, you do have the commander at the top of the ladder. But at the end of the day, on the battlefields, you know, you have mid-rank officers, the rank and file, and those are still there, and those are more motivated than ever. And that also explains why they are actually hoping for a major invasion by the Israeli army. But the problem is they know in Tel Aviv that if they go there, they're going to lose and they're going to suffer quite a lot of casualties. The Israeli army is very good when it comes to technology, intel, softwares, etc. But the problem is that 20, 30 years ago, a big decision was made by the Ministry of Defense saying that now the Israeli army is going to rely mainly on technology. The point was we don't want to have casualties anymore. The aim was to have an army that would suffer as close as possible to zero casualties, zero dead, zero wounded, meaning that the Israeli army no longer knows how to fight on the ground. And we see that in Gaza, by the way. The Israeli army has way more difficulties on the ground than when they bombard from the air. That's also why Benjamin Netanyahu, from the beginning of the war, said, I don't want any media on the ground, because obviously he didn't want anyone to see what the Israeli army would do, but also he didn't want anyone to see how the Israeli army on the ground is not really prepared for that, which is completely the opposite on the Hezbollah side. They fought against Israel, the guerrilla kind of warfare from 1982 to 2000. Then they fought in Syria. They are still fighting in Syria. So the Hezbollah combatants, they know how to fight on the ground. So they're hoping for the Israelis to come seriously and on the ground so they can reach them and inflict serious damage to the Israeli army. So obviously, Israel gained here a battle, or like basically they really inflicted serious damage, like especially at the emotional level, to a lot of people in Lebanon, not just Hezbollah. But in the same time, what we saw is that kind of galvanized or reinforced the determination of the combatants, because now they have an extra reason to fight the Israelis and not obviously to raise the white flag. Now they need to avenge their gone leader.
A less personalized version of the triumphalist narrative I've heard is that the assassination, and before that the pager attacks, revealed just how much Israeli intelligence has penetrated the organization, leading to distrust, paranoia, demoralization, and fear. What do you say to that?
The surprise effect was definitely there. All the same, we also know that the counter-intel of Hezbollah already smelled the odor of something wrong, because there was some talk a few days before the series of explosions. There was some talk within Hezbollah about, like, those pagers might be compromised and we should keep them away. And that's also why, for instance, the pagers made the most damage in the civil apparatus, but didn't really hurt the military, because they already got rid of them before. And it is true that here the Israeli intel gained a point. But in the same time, what I found very interesting is that while Hezbollah was still dizzy, I would say, of what happened with the pagers, it took them less than 3 days, while being supposedly completely despaired, according to the Israelis, and lost and whatever. It took them 3 days to identify who within the Mossad was responsible for the operation, who thought of it, who basically organized it. They found the brigade of the Mossad, who was in charge of that project. They also identified in which military bases they were settled. And 3 days after the pager incident and the assassination of the two military commanders, they launched a series of rockets on that military base in Tel Aviv at 6 a.m. in the morning before breakfast.
One explanation for the attacks I've read, or the assassination in particular, that I've read, is that Hezbollah had agreed to pull back to the Litani River on the condition of a ceasefire in Gaza. This was unacceptable for Israel, and so they went on the attack instead. Do you think there's anything to that?
I'm not sure that Hezbollah had agreed to pull back to the Litani River, and if they did, I'm pretty sure that they intended to come back very quickly to the south of the Litani River, for a very simple reason. It's not Hezbollah's type to basically accept anything coming from Israel. Another thing is that at the end of the day, both Hezbollah and the people of the south consider that Hezbollah is on his turf. He's in his home, basically, so he can be wherever he wants. Plus, we have to keep in mind that a large part of the Hezbollah organization, the members are part of the Lebanese society, so maybe militarily Hezbollah would have gone a little bit more discreet and pretend like I'm not there, I'm to the south of the Litani. But obviously the members on a daily basis, you know, they're part of the Lebanese social fabric, you know, they're everywhere. Basically you could go and buy your bread or ask for your mechanic to fix your car, and those guys are part of the Hezbollah organization. So if you really want no more Hezbollah to the south of the Litani River, you're going to have basically to empty South Lebanon from all in its inhabitants. You know, that's quite a lot of people to move to the north of the Litani. So I'm a little bit suspicious about that. No, I think what really made it for Israel, like, was really like the straw that broke the camel's back, and which led them basically to launch what the various operations that are going on in Lebanon for now more than a week. I think the problem is more the fact that the rockets of Hezbollah's participation in the Gaza war has in a way made it impossible, at least for quite some time, for the people of the north of Israel to go back to their homes. So in a way, Hezbollah used the Israeli strategy of 1978, which was to create a buffer zone in South Lebanon. So in a way, Hezbollah returned the ID to the Israelis, and it definitely looked as if Hezbollah was trying to create a buffer zone in the north of Israel, like, we don't have any civilians anymore there, we're going to have only military. And we know that Hezbollah's strategy has always been to avoid as much as possible to strike on the Israeli civilians and focus on the military. And that's basically what we see, by the way, yesterday. Like, there's that whole part of the north of Israel that was declared 100% a military zone only. And that's a problem. I think that was the real problem for Netanyahu. It's like, I cannot accept that. Plus, we have to keep in mind that he was between, and he is still stuck between a rock and a hard place. So things are not going exactly as he wishes, at the pace he wishes, with the Palestinians. okay, in Gaza. Then we have a lot of pressure at from the Israeli society itself, you know, the whole thing about him not accepting a deal with the Palestinians, with Hamas, for the return of the hostages. And guess what? A few days later, we found new Israeli hostages being dead. Israeli society came to a point where they want results. It's been a whole year. The whole world now is loathing Israel. At least almost all the world is hating Israel for what it does. Israel is put under pressure by international institutions, the international court, So in a way, it's like it has, at the end of the day, this should come to something. Like, we need a result. Plus, there's that situation with Lebanon where we have other Israelis not being able to go back to their homes. So that's, again, some extra pressure on the Israeli government. So Netanyahu is in a situation where he needed to score points at some point, whether on the Palestinian dossier or on the Lebanese one.
I'm speaking with the political scientist Aurélie Daher. What effects will this have on Lebanese society more broadly? I mean, as you pointed out, the organization has a military and a civilian wing. The civilian wing is deeply embedded in Lebanese society and politics. What effect would this damage to the military wing have on the broader society?
So for the Lebanese in general, if we look at the whole Lebanese society, whether Shia or not Shia, I would say that in the very short term, the word is sacred national unity. Israel managed to achieve something that was absolutely unheard of in the history of Lebanon. We even saw the most ferocious adversaries of Hezbollah, starting with the leader of the far right, the Christian far right in Lebanon, Sami Jarrah, the head of the Lebanese forces. Even he, who basically eats Hezbollah members for breakfast, because he loathes them so much. Basically, even he said, you know what, let's leave our internal differences aside for a while today, you know, with what is happening, the aggression against our homeland, against our society. We should all stand on the side of the victims of the attacks of the week of September 16th. So they basically, he's not saying literally Hezbollah, but he said the victims of the pager attack. And so basically he's telling it is Hezbollah without voicing the word. And even he said that. We saw also Sunni people who also, for some of them, have their issues with Hezbollah. We saw them like go to the hospitals, the clinics, etc., give their blood for the hospitals to support the victims. We saw Christian people, Jewish people, Sunni people open their homes for the Shia refugees coming from the south. So for now, the idea is national unity. Probably when things will come down, then we'll have some discussions about how did we end up to the situation. Maybe we already heard a few comments about, yeah, Hassan Nasrallah is dead, this is terrible, but in the same time, it's his fault, he had it coming, you know, who asked him to go and join the Gaza war? After all, that's not our war, that's a Palestinian war, we should have stayed aside, etc., stuff like that. Probably that will come back to the front of the discussions between the various Lebanese political forces after everything comes down. There's something personally that I see nobody's talking about, is that I'm not sure that the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah at the domestic level is good news for the adversaries of Hezbollah. You know, Hassan Nasrallah, again, whether you like the guy or not, whether you agreed or not, the guy was very keen on maintaining civil peace in Lebanon. For him, it was very important not to have the Lebanese fight against each other, especially not violently, etc. And most of the times when, you know, we had like tension between the Shia on one side and other communities or other political forces on the ground, his recommendation was immediately, I want everybody to come down. I want all the Shia to go home. No retaliation. If you are called names, etc., I don't want you to answer. Let it slide. National unity is way more important than anything. And the problem is that today we have a huge machine, very powerful machine called Hezbollah. We're going to have a new leadership. You know, in 10 years, in 20 years, Hezbollah will still be there. And we have absolutely no assurance that maybe one day somebody is going to take the head of that very powerful organization that has actually the means to crush any serious critique or any serious opposition to their choices, you never know who's going to take the lead of that powerful organization. So that powerful organization was so far harmless for the Lebanese because it was ruled by a guy who was, you know, rather moderate and reasonable and didn't want a civil war. The problem is the Shia today, especially the young generations, they're very pissed at a lot of people in Lebanon. Some of them really are not into the mood of taking the critiques and the insults and the provocation, especially after the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah. Now, before, with Hassan Nasrallah, they would listen to the leadership of Hezbollah. When Nasrallah said, I don't want anyone answering the provocations, I don't want anyone calling anyone names, etc., out of loyalty and respect for Nasrallah, you know, the Shia basically would comply. The problem is, we never know if one day we have a guy who's not that tolerant, who's not that reasonable, or we have somebody who will say at the head of Hezbollah, I don't want any retaliation. I want all the Shia to stay at home, but he's not charismatic enough to be listened to. Then this is where we're going to have serious trouble in Lebanon. And the adversaries of Hezbollah, who are now like dancing a belly dance, you know, and opening champagne saying, way, yay, wonderful, Hassan is gone. They know what they lost, but I'm not sure they're sure about what they're going to get instead.
Can Israel neutralize or destroy Hezbollah without inflicting enormous amounts of death and damage to Lebanon? Are we going to see a rerun of Gaza?
We're seeing Israel doing exactly that. They're trying to neutralize Hezbollah through death and damage and destruction. They're also hitting, that's a little bit different than what they did in 2006, they're also hitting other areas of Lebanon, not just the Shia ones. Obviously, probably that the reasoning is, I'm going to try to create some rancor between the Lebanese, and eventually they're going to, you know, start maybe a civil war or something once everything will come down. But I don't think we're going to have something like Gaza. The international community is a little bit tired of Mr. Netanyahu's strategies, well, at least on the West, on the European side, maybe not the American one. But on the European side, you know, we're starting to hear like serious criticism and we have things like the diplomatic medias where like we're seriously thinking about what kind of leverage we have to make that stop. Another problem is that Israel itself, you know, Israel in 2006 went with objectives that they couldn't technically achieve, and eventually that meant that they lost the war. So if they do not want to lose the war, they cannot have very ambitious objectives in Lebanon because they won't be able to achieve them. So once again, it's going to be 1-0 for Lebanon against Israel on the pitch. Another thing also is that Lebanon is not Gaza, even for, you know, the international community. I'm going to say it very plainly, and I'm really sorry for it because I hate what I'm going to say. It's awful, but it's sociologically true. Unfortunately, in the West, nobody cares very much about Palestinians dying by the dozens, by the thousands, by the dozens of thousands. Nobody care about them. Nobody care about Palestinian genocide. But the international community, especially France, care a little bit more about the Lebanese. It's a sad thing because all lives should be equal, but I'm not sure that some countries, some governments, especially in Europe, and I'm talking especially about France, I'm not sure that they're looking at the Gaza issue the way they're looking at the Lebanese issue. So probably they'll make more effort to end this quickly, or at least the tragedy that is now happening in Lebanon not to last as long as it's been lasting in Gaza.
Okay, and finally, journalists have this debased habit of speculating in the future. So I'm going to ask you to do that. Is Hezbollah going to be able to regenerate itself from these blows? They're bloodied but not severely wounded. And will they continue to be a strong force in the region?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Hezbollah works like an army. Okay, it is an army. So you lose officers, you have other officers to basically replace them. They're going to come up with a new leadership. I would say the main challenge in the, maybe not in the short run, but the middle run, the middle term, they have to find somebody who's going to be able to establish with the Lebanese society and especially the Shia community a relation of trust, respect, we will never have somebody as that the Lebanese society, especially the Shia, adore as much as they did with Nasrallah. But then again, we never know. But Hassan Nasrallah had a special track. You know, he had that special also history. You know, there's a personal life behind Nasrallah that are a little bit particular, atypical, I would say. So the challenge is to find a leadership that will reestablish a strong emotional relation with its audience, with its public. Now, when it comes to the organization, the civil organization will still working as it always did. That's not, nothing's going to change there. You know, we're going to still have the same social action or association foundations, etc. We still have people to run them. That's not going to change. At the military level, as I said, we have like a new generation, what I call the heirs, with cap for the letter H, the heir. Hassan Nasrallah, the Generation Nasrallah, also I call them that way, a new generation of fighters who are now already doing whatever they can to be accepted to enroll in the military. So we're going to have new blood coming from the bottom. We're going to have a bit of reorganization, you know, a little bit of officers who will, you know, go up on the ranking ladder. So guys who were number 3, 4 are going to become number 3 or 2, something like that. And yes, and, you know, the thing about their communication, you know, being compromised, that's really an easy thing to fix. And actually, it's already been fixed. You know, they just got rid of the former pager. They took the old ones. They're going to probably change the provider. Whether in Taiwan or in Hungary. And, you know, that's honestly something easy to fix. But the way I see it is they will probably work more on their intel and counter intel. I'm not worried about Hezbollah still being there in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years and still being to do, you know, a lot of things at the regional level. They're still there. They're still in Syria. They're still fighting in Syria, you know. The brigades that are still at home in charge with defending the Lebanese territory, they're still there. And actually, the death of Nasrallah made them, as I said, more motivated than ever.
That's Aurélie Dyer, professor of political science at University of Paris Dauphine and Sciences Po Paris. Her book, Hezbollah, Mobilization and Power, was published in 2019 by Oxford University Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, more Shostakovich. This some of the fourth movement from his piano trio number 2, performed by Emmanuel Axe, Yo-Yo Ma, and Isaac Stern. Till next week, bye.